From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The global recession brings global insecurity. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Former President Bush warned of an axis of evil poised to use nuclear weapons in support for international terrorism. Now the director of national intelligence and the head of the CIA say the bigger threat is political instability caused by global recession. In Russia and Eastern Europe, the Middle East, Africa, Asia, and Mexico, local upheaval could have ugly consequences worldwide. Will the industrial nations continue to prop up sagging economies, or are they too preoccupied with their own problems to look up and see what's coming? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the Dalai Lama calls Tibet a hell on earth. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, back with To the Point. Forget the axis of evil. Economic recession now threatens political upheaval in important parts of the world, with national security consequences here in the U.S. We'll look at potential sources of trouble today. Is Washington paying attention? On Reporter's Notebook, 50 years after he fled Tibet, the Dalai Lama delivers a blistering critique of China. First, this news update. The U.S. stock markets rallied this morning as Citibank announced its biggest profits since 2007, and Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke called for a sweeping overhaul of financial regulations.
The main lesson that's been learned is how powerful and how pervasive these financial market effects can be. But the way I would phrase my answer would be to say that it depends critically on our ability to get the banking system and the financial system more broadly, not necessarily back to 2005, but back to a situation where the markets are reasonably stable and they can perform their critical function of providing credit to the economy. If we can do that, then I think that there's a good chance that the recession will end later this year and that 2010 will be a period of growth.
Ben Bernanke speaking today at the Council on Foreign Relations. Craig Torres is Federal Reserve correspondent for Bloomberg News. And Craig, thanks for being with us.
Sure.
What's it going to take to accomplish that objective and get the banking system back on track, according to Mr. Bernanke?
Well, the Treasury has its plan. It'll conduct a stress test, that is, force banks to look at how they'd perform in worst-case scenario, at which point the banks have to ask, do they have to go and raise more money from shareholders or even the government? And what banks do with that capital is they make loans on it. So it's going to take a while.
Going to take a while. Bernanke suggests it might happen at the end of this year. That's a pretty optimistic prediction, isn't it?
Well, their own forecasts show that for the full year, the economy will be negative. And they also show unemployment continuing to rise into 2009. So while he was optimistic, I'd say probably only mildly optimistic. And based on what I've heard from his past testimony, you know, that what he presented there was probably the best-case scenario, not the central point of their forecast.
There are those who are saying that the credit default swaps worldwide are going to end up costing so much if they'll have to take over AIG and Citibank and others as well. Obviously, nationalization is not something he wants to talk about.
Correct. Well, you could say, Warren, they've already, in some respects, taken over AIG.
Yeah.
They're forcing the wind down of that company. They've committed billions of dollars to it. Citibank, they probably don't want to take it over, according to bank analysts, because then the investors will just move on and say, well, who's next? So you have to be very careful, analysts say, about how you incentivize private capital markets with what you do as a government.
Without causing a run on the banks like Citibank. Well, what about this announcement of profits today?
Well, it's not really an announcement. It's like a forecast. The Citibank hasn't really reported for profits, but the chairman says they made money in the first couple months of the year. So you have to think also, though, I was talking to a money manager this morning, and he said the income statement is one thing, but the balance sheet where all these assets are is another question. So you have to think, have a lot of these assets moved off cities' balance sheet. The government's insured some of them against losses. But certainly the housing market isn't improving. It doesn't look like it is. Employment is not improving. So I'm not sure what to think about it. We'll have to see.
Thank you for being careful about the language here. The chief executive of Citibank, Vikram Pandit, says his bank is having the best quarter since 2007 when it last posted a profit. So that's not the same thing as saying they're making money. What about Elizabeth Warren, the chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel? She says the program to shore up the banks may exhaust the resources of the federal government.
Depends on – so right now the government's got the – specifically the Treasury, a two-pronged plan that it's trying to put in place. One is this so-called stress test, where banks look at a worst-case scenario and ask themselves, do we need more money? And if they go to shareholders and shareholders say, sorry, there's no more money for you, then they have to go to the government. And then the second part of the – so that'll be expensive. The second part of the plan is removing the assets from the banks. The government says it can do this in what they call a public-private partnership. That means there'd be some government funds, some investor funds. Again, taxpayers would be on the hook. The cost of these programs over time for you and I, our children, anybody's guess, I would say, right now. It depends on how the assets perform.
Very quickly, Bernanke today called for a new agency to protect from losses and from all this happening again. Is that something that could happen soon, or would that take some time to establish?
Well, the Fed can't establish that agency. It's really up to Congress. And Congress seems to have a split view. House Financial Services Chairman Barney Frank likes the idea of an Uber regulator. The Senate, I think, is much less optimistic about the Fed's performance and has looked back at the Fed's performance in the past. So we'll just have to see how it goes.
Craig Torres, Federal Reserve correspondent for Bloomberg News. Many thanks.
You're welcome.
In a moment, the global recession brings global insecurity on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Alney back with To the Point. The World Bank says the global economy will shrink this year for the first time since the 1940s. Falling demand in the West has led to the sharpest drop in world trade in 80 years. Developing countries can't sell their products or their commodities, and millions of jobs are disappearing. The result of the economic crisis could be political instability, and U.S. intelligence agencies say that's becoming a greater threat to national security than international terrorism. Stephen Schrage is at the Center of for Strategic and International Studies. He was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State under Colin Powell and co-chair of the G8's Anti-Crime and Terrorism Group. Stephen Schrage, good to have you on our program.
Thank you. I think you raise a very important point.
Well, elaborate on it, if you will, and tell us, is this something that has been considered for some time, or is this just dawning on people in Washington?
Well, I think some of us have been talking about it for a while, but I think it's really just starting to resonate with the intelligence agencies and some others. What's interesting, there's been a lot of talk about the greatest lessons of the Great Depression, but some of them seem to be missing the most important point, which was followed by the rise of authoritarian regimes, instability, and ultimately mass conflict. And we're not at that point today, and the risks are very different. But as you see riots from Latvia to China, and meanwhile, security issues like Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons haven't gone away, the massive population bulge of potential joblessness in the Middle East, there's an opportunity for economic insecurity to feed on security concerns and kind of spark a downward spiral that we really need to focus on avoiding.
When you talk about the lessons of the Depression, you also said that now things are somewhat different. How are they different?
Well, I think, in the Great Depression, with the rise of authoritarian regimes, it was much more of a traditional risk base that we had. Today, with transnational threats, interconnected economic flows, again, one loose nuclear weapon could kill more people than died in all of World War II. So while we also have more robust intelligence and regimes, we've also got greater dangers.
So what are we doing in this context, or what do we need to do, I guess, I should say? The World Bank says continue to support developing economies.
Well, I think we're going to have to. I mean, obviously the World Bank has an interest. That's their focus, to promote that. And I think that's true. I think we can't take our eye off the ball of those concerns. We've also got to be worried about rising protectionism and nationalism. And while there's a huge economic interest in nations turning inward, we've got to realize that we live in an interconnected world of both transnational economic realities and transnational threats. So we've got to be able to work together and not lose that focus at this time.
Talk a little bit more about the economic downturn and how it can lead to security threats.
Well, there's a number of different ways, one of which is just, you know, the first order effects are obviously you're seeing riots and instability in terms of democracies and pressure on other governments that may make them turn inward or become more nationalistic, which can kind of spark new protectionism, a race to the bottom, or just kind of a withdrawal from international institutions that might prop up against security threats. You also could see, again, like in the instance of Iran pursuing a nuclear weapon, you may have lessened focus on security measures to counter that, or lessened ability to provide sanctions or political leadership to address those issues. So there's a whole range of ways, both direct and indirect, that kind of taking our eye off the ball of security threats because of economics could have a negative security impact.
But the impulse to take our eye off the ball is terrific, isn't it? It's great, given the nature of the current economic crisis, which of course started here in the United States.
It's gigantic. And one of the most, I guess, visceral ways to see this is you look at the front pages a year ago. It was talking about Iran, about North Korea, about Afghanistan and Iraq. Now those are in the back pages, and we're talking about economic bubbles and challenges in the housing market. And both issues are very valid today. The security issues haven't gone away, and again, they're very interconnected. A new attack, turmoil in the Middle East could throw out all the economic models that are looking at recovery in 2009 or 2010.
Stephen Schrage, once again at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, formerly with the State Department during the regime of Colin Powell. David Sanger is chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. He's author most recently of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts, and the Challenges to American Power. David Sanger, good to have you back.
Oh, great to be back with you.
Are people in Washington now paying attention?
Well, they are paying attention. And, you know, while it's true that I think our front page has probably got, you know, a heavier emphasis these days on the economic travails. I get the sense, certainly in talking to the Obama administration and certainly in the pages of the New York Times, we haven't forgotten about these other issues that are exacerbated, I think, by the economic instability. I guess I'd cast it just slightly differently by saying, look, we've had a nuclear problem with Iran for 20 years. We just didn't know about it well until about 7 years ago. We've had nuclear problems with North Korea, the world's ultimate failed state, for 25 years. Many of these issues, of course, predated the economic issues. At the same time, I think that what we've seen happen now is both a geographic spreading of the problem and a worsening of it when you combine it with some of the issues that we've just been discussing. Eastern Europe now, a place that was just seen as sort of a great emerging market a year ago, is now seen as a potential arc of instability. There's a lot of question about whether or not the downturn in the oil markets gives us leverage over Iran, because finally sanctions might get their attention, or whether, in fact, it drives the Iranians to speed up their nuclear program. So in each place you go around the world, this changes the equation.
Back to Stephen Schrage at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. There's an article in the current Foreign Policy magazine called Axis of Upheaval by Neil Ferguson, who says that what we're going to see now, or what we're liable to see, is first economic volatility, then ethnic disintegration. And finally, what he refers to as an empire in decline, suggesting that the United States and its presence around the world is less effective than it has been in the past. Can you comment on all that?
Well, that's a wide-ranging view.
It sure is.
I am not one that believes in the U.S. decline if we play our cards right over this period. I mean, I think you've seen with the U.S., you know, a dollar strengthening and kind of the signs of our reserve currency, that people are looking to the United States for leadership. I think Barack Obama has said he's going to engage through the G20 and elsewhere to lead the way forward. I think it's going to take new modes of collaboration, working with China, working with a range of different countries. But I think that it's important to sound those kind of warnings about what could go wrong. But I think with leadership, we can avoid that. And actually, the United States has a lot of leverage and a lot of capability to lead right now.
Back to David Sanger with the New York Times. When you talk to people in Washington now, as the Obama administration begins to take over, what do they think is the greatest potential threat nationally and internationally?
Well, let's start internationally. Of course, they're all interlinked. You hear much more about Mexico now ever since the sort of worsening of these drug-related attacks, and the sense that the drug lords are much better armed than the police are, and that the government continues its problems with maintaining control. I would say that further from home, the biggest concern, single concern you hear is Pakistan, since that is a case where three insurgencies are underway at one time. You know, the Al-Qaeda, the big T Taliban who are going off into Afghanistan, and the sort of small T Taliban, people like Masood, who is attacking the actual Pakistani government. And that's where you've seen a number of the U.S. Predator raids in recent times, an effort to sort of go after his network. But I think their biggest concern right now is that a country like Pakistan, on the edge in the best of times, could go into bankruptcy while it is also trying to combat these kinds of insurgencies. And then you could go around the world to some of the other hotspots, including neighboring Afghanistan, where, again, the effort to help one of the poorest countries in the world is undercut to some degree by this downturn.
We'll hear more about Mexico and about Africa as well a little bit later on our program. First, here's Jonathan Broder. He's senior editor in defense and foreign policy for Congressional Quarterly in Washington. Jonathan, good to have you on our program.
Good to talk to you.
Is the U.S. pulling back, do you think, perhaps not in terms of its military presence around the world, but for its support for the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and these organizations that are asking for more money to help the developing nations so that these threats don't evolve into something more dangerous?
No, I don't see the United States pulling back, but I think there's a recognition that these international lending organizations only have so much money. And what we've seen is some developing countries, including Pakistan, approaching cash-rich countries like the oil-rich countries of the Persian Gulf, which have lots of foreign currency reserves, rather than go to the World Bank and perhaps be uncomfortable with the kind of conditions that they place on their loans, they're going to some of these cash-rich countries. But I don't see the United States pulling back.
What about the Congress? Is the Congress focused appropriately on this broad international threat, or is it turning inward, looking more toward protectionism, perhaps nationalism as well, even here in the United States?
Well, you know, foreign policy was never the strong suit of Congress. It's much more focused internally. What I see as interesting is that there is a debate going on now over the defense budget. And Obama's people, I think, very much understand the threat that's out there. The place where you see this playing out is in the defense budget. We don't expect very much of a change in the defense budget for fiscal 2010. Obama has already come out with the top line figure, and that figure is going to be roughly a 2-4% increase over the baseline budget of last year. And one of the reasons why Obama doesn't want to mess with the defense budget this year is that he's got so many other things on his plate. The rising unemployment, particularly, is something that would be affected even more if he were to cut defense spending, and particularly cut certain weapons programs, which would lead to layoffs. However, in the out years, in 2011, 2012, there's going to be a big battle over these weapon systems. Obama, of course, is going to try to cut back on some of these weapons programs so that the resources can be put into more of a strategy to meet the kind of threats we've been talking about. One of the previous guests had talked about the need for U.S. leadership on this. I think that one of the problems that Obama is going to have is going to be right back here on Capitol Hill when he tries to cancel some of these programs in a gesture of U.S. leadership, and the parochial concerns of the various members of Congress come to the fore as they try to protect these programs, which are largely built in their districts. And it's not going to be so easy to cancel some of these massive weapons programs, which cost billions of dollars, which are way behind schedule, they're over budget, and they're not particularly the kind of weapons that we need to face the kind of threats that we're facing.
We talked last week on this program about the F-22, about this enormous ship that the Navy is building, which many intelligence reports say is vulnerable to attack. The F-22 are not supposed to be all that great for what it's evolved, designed for. And, of course, the president has had no more Cold War weapons. I think that's what he's talking about in this context. Stephen Schrage, back to you. You were the one who said U.S. leadership is being called upon here. Do you think Congress will stick with the kind of support that is required for other countries if, in fact, it requires a kind of choice between that and job-creating defense projects?
Well, that's going to be the key challenge. And I may have a little bit different take on some of the defense budget issues because I worry about too rapid of a drawdown because I don't know who's going to fill that security vacuum if we're not prepared 5-10 years down the road. But I do worry about your larger point. And the one that the guest just mentioned about Congress kind of withdrawing the Obama administration or others' intent to engage internationally. That's traditionally been a risk. I think they've done a good job in talking about increasing foreign aid and spending on the State Department budget, but those are tough to plus up in the best of times. And I imagine they're going to come under extreme political pressure on those points going forward as well.
David Sanger, your book, The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to America Power, that's exactly what we're talking about here. What about the Congress in this situation?
You know, the Congress in this situation, I think, is going to end up being, in many ways, more of a complicating factor for President Obama than anything else. And I think you've run through a few of these. You know, killing off any weapon system, even if you determine that it is no longer designed for the conflict or potential conflicts you find yourself in, is very difficult because as soon as the national security arguments fall away, then somebody from that district, that state, is bringing up the job creation one. You know, what became critical for national security suddenly becomes critical for economic stimulus.
Okay.
So that's number one. And I guess the second area that is complicating is that I think you're going to see more and more protectionist tendencies.
David Sanger with the New York Times, many thanks for being with us. We're going to continue this conversation with our other guests in a moment on Reporter's Notebook. As China faces the 50th anniversary celebration of his departure, the Dalai Lama calls Tibet a hell on earth. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warman Alney back with To the Point, once again talking about the global recession today with possibly now a greater threat to national security than international terrorism with the economic downturn leading to political instability in various countries with ugly consequences quite likely to result. Joel Kibazo is an associate fellow in the Africa program at Chatham House in London. That's a think tank focused on international affairs. And Joe Kibazo, thank you very much for being on our program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a bit about Africa in this context, and particularly Kenya.
Well, the problems I see there are sort of severalfold. First and foremost, I mean, a place such as Kenya has depended on remittances of people working in Europe, people working in the United States. I think the latest estimates were that was bringing in about $1 billion or more, just over the $1 billion. Now, but as we moved into the end of 2008, that fell to about by about 50% because of the global economic crisis, as people lost jobs in Europe, lost jobs in the USA. Now, that of course means that the money that's been coming in and that all that going to families and whatnot starts when once it evaporates, there is that vacuum. What happens? The government can't make up the shortfall, and people start looking to other things. Now, Kenya is particularly important strategically. I mean, there's been a lot of military exercises that go on in Kenya, particularly Port of Mombasa. The U.S. Has had troops in the area. And we mustn't forget that Kenya was one of the first places where the Al-Qaeda bombed in 1998, and we've had several bombs that have gone off and a number of people killed, particularly in Mombasa and Nairobi in the last few years. So for me, it's what is interesting there is that the economic downturn puts pressure on people, and people start looking to other things, and increasingly the radicalization of some of the youths in the more Muslim Islamic part of Kenya, such as Mombasa. And I think that is where some of the threat will come from. The other thing you've got to understand is that Kenya is the place where, you know, that's being seen as a lookout for places such as Somalia, which I think many of your listeners will perhaps realize has been to all intents and purposes, a broken state. And the military actions go on that is going on there, the terrorism. It's a whole thing. It's not, in many ways, not even a unified state as we can know a country. So those threats are increased if defense spending declines because of the international economic situation, and it leads to all sorts of ripples right across the region.
What about Sudan?
Well, Sudan was the other one I was going to mention, that we do have, that of course also creates a problem. Kenya's right next door to Sudan. Kenya's used very much as a gateway, particularly into the southern part of Sudan. We know that the regime in Sudan has sort of is starting to bring down the shutters because it feels as if the West is bringing pressure on it. We have to do the situation in Darfur. So basically, the Darfur situation will continue, but also there is this fear I have that the regime will start acting really as if it feels it's on its own and really must react. I mean, we saw the International Criminal Court, the indictment of the president last week in the International Criminal Court. So those kind of threats, I'm afraid, could lead to great instability in the region as a whole.
And, of course, when the ICC indictment came down, he pulled out a lot of the groups that were helping the people in Darfur and elsewhere, which I suspect will greatly worsen the situation there.
It greatly worsens the situation, but it's also a signal. He is saying, right, you do that, and this is just the beginning of what could happen. Now we're talking about millions of people in the region, 4 or 5 million people who could be affected by this. There's many, many people who are in camps. If you withdraw the humanitarian aid, what is to happen to them? They've already lost their homes because of the fighting. They've got nowhere else to turn. Then you have a human catastrophic situation there.
And how do these situations in Kenya, in Somalia, and in Sudan threaten the rest of the world outside of Africa?
Well, they threaten the rest of the world in a number of ways. First and foremost, that you do have greater migration because of, you know, people are able to move. And first and foremost, they move across borders. So you find that, for instance, you had the rebel movement in southern Sudan being across the borders in Kenya and Uganda. Now you have the rebel movement that was attacking Uganda that had been moving into Sudan, moving into the Democratic Republic of Congo. So these are porous borders. So if there's conflict in one area, you create refugee situations. You also create the movement of the militarized people who are going across the borders. It is very easy to move. Secondly, internationally, what it does is that some people may want to take the conflict offshore. And these days, that is the easiest thing to do. So places such as Sudan and North Africa are not that far from Europe. It's not that difficult to get to Europe. So those are things, therefore, that one has to worry about, that the easy movement and easy flow might see some of the problems spill over, one, into other nations in the region, but then spill over into other parts of the world.
Joel Kibazo, Associate Fellow at the Africa Program at Chatham House in London. Jonathan Broder still with us, Senior Editor in Defense and Foreign Policy for the Congressional Quarterly in Washington. The Pentagon has made an effort to set up an Africa Command. What's happened to that?
Well, it's going ahead. Interestingly, there are no African countries that have agreed to host the command headquarters. So for now, the command is still based out of Europe. But what that command is trying to do is its main concern is following up on what we just heard, is that in these countries of great instability, or if they're failing, you have what is known as ungoverned spaces, where the government authority does not extend to those areas. And the fear at the Pentagon and in Washington is that groups like Al-Qaeda or affiliated groups like Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, which is in North Africa, will use these ungoverned spaces to train and plan attacks against Western targets. So what the Africa Command is doing is it's sending special forces and other military outfits down into Africa, where they are doing two things. They are training the national armies of these countries like Mauritania and Chad, and at the same time they are going into these ungoverned spaces and trying to win the hearts and minds of the local population by doing very unmilitary things like digging wells, building a school, improving roads, infrastructure, that sort of thing. And the idea is that if you win over the hearts and minds of the local population, then they will be a very good source of intelligence for where the bad guys are and what they're doing. And then the military end of these teams that are there can go in and wipe them out. So it's sort of classic counterinsurgency strategy, where the actual use of military force really only comprises maybe 10 to 20% of the entire effort, and most of the effort is devoted to winning hearts and minds with civilian projects.
Now, Joel Kibazo, back to you at Chatham House. Can we afford to do that without also providing economic assistance and trying to maintain the governments and the almost governments of countries like Somalia at the same time?
I don't actually think it's possible. I think there's two things. One, I mean, and your guest talked about, you know, the absence of the fact that the U.S. command hasn't managed to get the force into Africa itself. There's a reason for that, but the biggest being that the African countries are very nervous about being seen as supporting the U.S. Outright and therefore becoming targets of terrorism groups. So that is the main factor for that. But in terms of your question in terms of about the economic support that is needed, that is very crucial, particularly to countries such as Kenya, because they cannot afford the military spend that is needed in terms of intelligence. Secondly, in terms of being able to go after some of the rogues, the rogues and terrorist groups that are operating in the region. When you have challenges on education, challenges on roads and schools, and you've got a decline in money that has been coming in because of remittances being down, because the budgetary support is down, because other countries are suffering, you know, those that had given money before. So they cannot afford to do it. So I actually don't think there is an alternative for powers such as the United States saying that, look, at the least we shall come in and help you, particularly on issues of defense and supporting you to at least be able to gather intelligence and also in the military sphere to be able to at least contain this problem.
Joel Kibazo at Chatham House. Earlier, David Sanger, when I asked him about international threats because of economic instability, mentioned Mexico first of all. Sam Quinones is with the Los Angeles Times. He's part of a team working on a series of stories called Mexico Under Siege, also the author of Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, Truer Tales of Mexican Migration. And Sam Quinones, it's always good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
What we hear most about Mexico, it is not so much economic trouble as it is drug cartels, and drug cartels better armed than the government. But there is also, of course, an economic story behind this. Tell us about it.
Well, you know, I would say, though, that really what's happened in Mexico predated the downturn. I mean, really, if you look back to when the violence, the most savage violence began, it was in 05 along the border with Texas and Nuevo Laredo, the city of Nuevo Laredo, and spread from there and has kind of found hot spots all over the country, depending on which entry points for drugs into Mexico and exit points into the United States are under contention. So it's kind of shifted all over. However, always, of course, you know, there's the issue of unemployment or underemployment. Large masses of people in Mexico who are they need jobs. They're oftentimes very desperate. That's why they come here, of course. And so this is part of that. Of course, has been what's feeding. You know, they've been the soldiers in a sense. Some of those folks have been the soldiers in this drug war that's going on down in Mexico as well.
I understand that there's a drastic reduction in illegal immigration into this country, at least as measured by the number of arrests that are made at the border. That would suggest I take it a lot of people are staying in Mexico because they can't get work here. What will that mean in Mexico itself?
Well, two things are happening. One is that Mexicans aren't leaving, and the other is that Mexicans aren't returning as well. And because they know that there's no jobs back in Mexico either, the folks who are here. So what we have is kind of a static situation from about, I think, maybe early 07 or sometime around that period, where it's just kind of more or less the same. They expected with this downturn that you know, maybe millions of people would return to Mexico. That hasn't happened. The same thing is the reverse has not happened, of course, where people have come here in large numbers. One effect of all this is of this economic downturn lately, of course, has been to reduce the amount of remittances that Mexican immigrants from here send home. And remittances, like your guest from Kenya mentioned, are essential to large chunks of Mexico, particularly the north central part. Mexico received in 07, I believe the figure was somewhere around $26 billion in remittances from the United States, immigrants in the United States. That's dropped to 23 in 08. I suspect probably that'll drop further in this year. All that means that remittances were kind of like a function as a kind of a stabilizing force in Mexico, and the more they drop, the more chance for instability there is. The other thing, while they didn't go to the United to the government of Mexico, they did form this kind of stabilizing thing. At the same time, you've got this economic problem in Mexico, high unemployment. Having a devastating effect on the economy. That is reducing the amount of resources that the government has at a time when they really need them, because it's the central government that is really charged with fighting this drug war against these cartels. And tax revenues drop, remittances drop. All that means is probably going to be somewhat less money for the Mexican government to be able to fight this war.
The drug wars, as you indicated, have been extraordinarily violent, with thousands of people killed, murdered along the border, and gruesome stories of beheadings and all of that. Is that going across the border at this point? Is it threatening the peace in Texas and Arizona and New Mexico and California?
There are some examples of that, but I would say that the real story probably is that it's not happened as much as you might think, considering how savage and ferocious the war has been. I mean, what you're seeing here is a perfect example of one of the key problems Mexico faces. On one side, on the U.S. side, really because of local institutions, local drug task forces, local cops, local criminal justice, strong city governments and so on, you are seeing essentially that violence stop. On one side, for example, in Ciudad Juarez, you've got a horrible, horrible war with many hundreds of people killed in the last couple of years. And on El Paso's got the lowest crime rate in the United States, the big cities in the United States. What I think this war very interestingly, sadly, kind of shows is that Mexico really has a problem with its local institutions, which is why the army is being called to fight this war. It's really just a band of drug criminals. Normally, in any country, those are fought by local police, local drug task forces, a variety of kind of network of law enforcement, all very well paid, well trained, very, very enthusiastic, you might say, for their job. What this is showing is that this is one of the big problems Mexico faces now, is just its local institutions are simply too weak, too underfunded, too demoralized to be much of a help in what is essentially a crime war, more than an insurgency in the classic sense that you see in all other parts of the world.
Sam Quinones again with the Los Angeles Times, working on a series of stories called Mexico Under Siege. Let us end where we began with Stephen Schrage, who is now at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, formerly was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State during the Colin Powell regime at the State Department and co-chair of the G8's Anti-Crime and Terrorism Group. With respect particularly to Mexico, for years, first with regard to immigration, and now in terms of the gun trade that goes south and the drugs that come north, it has been said that the United States ought to be not only more involved, but more involved economically. Is this, and all that we've heard today, an argument for that?
I think it definitely is. And I think it also shows kind of how these issues have kind of waxed and waned over the years. For example, we had major kind of counter-drug institution-building programs with Mexico that were ramped up in the 80s and 90s. And with the war on terrorism, other than some of the border security pieces, has kind of leveled or dropped off. So these are kind of enduring, long-standing problems. And I think the last guest really hit the nail on the head in terms of how these are all interconnected. The economic problems, the remittances, the budget reductions, you know, these ramifications flow back and forth and impact economics and security, and it's important that we have a comprehensive vision of how to address these issues and see how interconnected they are.
Interconnected and, again, appearing on a global scale.
Yes. Definitely.
Stephen Schrage, thank you very much for being with us again with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks to Sammy Quinones with the LA Times, Joe Cabasso with Chatham House, Jonathan Broder with Congressional Quarterly in Washington, and David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for the New York Times. The religion, the culture, the language, and identity of Tibet are nearing extinction. That's according to the Dalai Lama today in a speech attacking China 50 years after an upheaval that caused him to flee Tibet for India. More on the speech and today's anniversary in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warren Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Last year, the 49th anniversary of the Dalai Lama's departure, there was a widespread rebellion in Tibet that led to brutal repression. This year, anticipating the 50th anniversary, China has cracked down hard. But that could make matters worse. That's according to Stephen D. Marshall, senior advisor and Tibet expert at the Congressional Executive Commission on China, which monitors human rights for Congress and the president. And Mr. Marshall, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be here.
Let's talk first about the Dalai Lama's speech today, which was much more aggressive and confrontational than the things that he has said in the past.
It is. It's about double the length of the statement that he made last year, and he gives, or rather summarizes, an indictment, if you will, of China's record in Tibet. He reaches back to the 1950s and brings it all the way up to the present and sums it up as a hell on earth. He does this, I believe, not by way of trying to attack China, but simply to point out that the grievances of the Tibetans, their negative experiences, are real things that have played out over several decades. He also reiterates very strongly, I think, his commitment to dialogue, to a negotiated settlement with China, and he makes an interesting shift in language referring to what he seeks as meaningful autonomy. He has generally been saying genuine autonomy over the past few years, but meaningful is probably an accurate and somewhat more flexible description of what he seeks.
Many people in Tibet, particularly younger people, are agitating for independence, as I understand it. Is the Dalai Lama liable to lose that argument as China cracks down?
I think the Tibetan audience inside under Chinese administration is very different than the Tibetan audience that lives in exile. The loyalty that Tibetans living in Tibet have to the Dalai Lama is, I believe, virtually unshakable. And the reason that the Tibetans living in Tibet are so propelled toward independence is that the Chinese policies leave them almost nowhere else to go. The Dalai Lama believes he can persuade them to accept a broader settlement. But certainly if things keep going in the direction they are, that some Tibetans will be turning in a very committed way toward independence, and that could create some problems for China.
Well, to what extent has Tibetan culture been infringed on to such an extent by the Han Chinese, who have moved in there now with the building of new roads and even a railroad into Tibet, that it's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to restore it to what it was before?
Well, I don't think... I think the Dalai Lama would be the first to admit that nothing could be restored or changed back to what it was before, but he's interested in retaining something, retaining the key elements of the culture, which are language, probably first and foremost. The Dalai Lama's special envoys handed over a detailed memorandum to Chinese officials last November outlining their position more specifically than ever before, and they stressed in that how important language is. The language is suffering. And then religion is another one. Religion is very much at the core of Tibetan identity, and as history has shown in a number of places in the world, even if religion encounters a lot of difficulty in a certain place or time, it can rebound. The environment is another one. There's been a lot of environmental damage in some parts of Tibet, but it's a huge place, and a lot of the environment remains pristine. So I think the Dalai Lama sees hope in this.
The Chinese argue that they have managed to get rid of a kind of slave culture that existed when the Dalai Lama was there and the religion was dominant. Is there any truth to that? Have there been improvements in Tibet by objective standards?
Well, I wasn't there in the 1940s or 50s, so I can't judge personally. But without a doubt, the economic system there and the political system there was not one that in the 21st century would be judged democratic or fair. But the real answer there is the one that comes from Tibetans. You know, it could be that even though a numerically large part of their population was an economic and social lower class, it was their system, and it was many of the people who are very angry right now about what China's doing are the very people that used to be what China calls serfs. But there's no doubt that in terms of infrastructure, access to education and health, there certainly China has invested a lot in this, and I think it would be unrealistic to say that they haven't achieved anything in that. The Tibetans would question whether or not the administration of it is fair, access to it is fair. With education, they would point out that, very importantly, the use of Tibetan language, therefore the importance of Tibetan language in society, has declined sharply.
There is to be, on the 28th of March this year, a new holiday, which the Chinese, as I understand it, are rather pushing the Tibetans to celebrate. What's the significance of that, and how is that likely to exacerbate problems rather than helping to solve them?
Well, it's a very important and very sensitive date. The Tibetan Autonomous Region, what is formerly called Tibet by the Chinese, passed a law in January establishing this holiday for the first time. It's the 50th anniversary of when the Chinese government disbanded the Dalai Lama's former Lhasa-based government, and this happened right after the days, literally after the Dalai Lama had fled into exile. So by creating this holiday at a very tense moment and forcing Tibetans to celebrate the end of the Tibetan government and by extension the Dalai Lama's flight into exile is it's provocative. And there have already been a couple of protests that we know of where officials were trying to force Tibetans, for example, to send a dance troupe to Lhasa to perform or something, and the local people just really could not accept this. So I think the security blanket, the intense security situation that exists right now, that's certainly going to continue to March 28th and somewhat beyond.
Very difficult to get information out?
Extremely difficult. What I've heard is anecdotal, obviously, but certainly over the last year they've collected a great deal of cell phones, and a lot of people who used to have wireless communication don't anymore, and I've heard that in some of the most sensitive areas they're actually turning off cell transmission facilities and interrupting access to internet in various ways. And the fact that today we have almost no news coming out about March 10th, other than what the Chinese government is publishing, which, of course, they say everything is peaceful and happy, this is very interesting to me. I think they've done a pretty good job of putting a cork in the information bottle now, but sooner or later somebody's going to send a report out and we'll know what's really happening.
All right. There are predictions, of course, of more disruptions to come, and we will see if that happens or not. Stephen Marshall at the Congressional Executive Commission on China, many, many thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Today's program produced by Christian Bordahl with Cameron Radziner and Sonia Geis. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.